In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
So many of us are familiar with that pre-COVID work environment. In the days before work from home, the norm was to trudge into an office 5 days a week from 9 to 5, while we mingled with people there, for all intents and purposes, strangers. Sure, you might spend the occasional evening sharing a beer or two over happy hour, but a lot of the time, we don't really know what goes on with our coworkers after hours. What they go home and complain to their partner or roommate about, what they do with their spare time, what plagues them as they lie awake in bed at night. We like to think that we can trust our employer, that they've done their due diligence and hired people that play nice with others. But how can you ever be sure? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in 2020 alone, there were close to 400 workplace homicides in the U.S., which means someone is out there right now sharing a workspace with a dangerous individual. And like today's victim, they probably have no idea. So to kick off today's case, I want to introduce you to a young woman named Annie Lee, born on July 3rd, 1985. Annie grew up in a small Northern California town called Placerville in a tight-knit family of first-generation Vietnamese Americans. Raised mostly by her aunt and uncle, Annie and her brother Chris, along with their three cousins, all shared a modest ranch-style home nestled in a quiet, wooded neighborhood. But from a young age, Annie was eager to stand out, to make her family proud of her accomplishments. They'd worked so hard to give her the opportunities that she had, she wanted to give a little something back. So in high school, Annie worked hard enough to become a member of the National Honor Society, which eventually turned into valedictorian. But Annie wasn't just wildly intelligent, she was also quite popular, winning superlatives like best of the best and most likely to be the next Einstein in the yearbook. During her graduation speech, the 4'11", 90-pound Annie stood before her classmates with the confidence of a towering CEO. She wore her heart on her sleeve, laying out her hopes and dreams for the future. With a passion for cellular biology, Annie told her classmates that she was planning to become a laboratory pathologist and was prepared to spend the next decade getting her MD. Can you imagine? Like, the last thing I was thinking in school, I wasn't good at school, first of all, but the last thing I was thinking in high school was, what am I going to do? I'm going to be a freaking MD? Like, that's insane. I wouldn't even know that was a career choice. But that's what I'm talking about. We need people like that. The problem was, despite Annie's incredible academic record, she didn't have an easy time receiving the scholarships that she needed to make the future she wanted a reality. It's expensive. 102 applications later, Annie had cobbled together enough money to finally get herself into college. I don't even know how long it would take to fill out 102 applications for scholarships, to be honest. Her first choice was Princeton University because of its unprecedented science program. But when Annie sent through her application in the spring of 2003, she was met with a rejection letter. I also have to mention here, so she gets rejected from Princeton, right? And something funny, and I'm including this because I want you to get a picture of Annie's personality. After getting rejected, she goes and applies to a couple backup colleges. And then she also sends a picture of her butt to the dean of admissions at Princeton. This was just kind of quirky side of Annie, or I should say, kind of quirky, upbeat character Annie always was. According to a fellow student of hers, she was the kind of girl who would, quote, wear 5-inch heels while doing mouth surgeries, eat fried chicken and not gain a pound, and use smiley faces in her presentations and not lose respect because of it. You'd think that sending a picture of her butt would get her into the school. You know what I'm saying? It'd be the opposite. She should have done it before she submitted her application. I mean, if I'm going to say that, it probably was a picture that looked more like on Grease when they mooned them at the dance. More mooning than it was like a sexy picture, for sure. So Annie knew she had a bright future ahead of her, wherever she ended up. Which, at least for undergrad, became the University of Rochester, located in western New York State, right along Lake Ontario. So Annie packed her bags to send goodbye to California and traveled 2,600 miles east to New York State, prepared to brave the harsh East Coast winters while beginning her degree in cell development biology. What Annie maybe didn't expect to find at the University of Rochester was the love of her life. After forming a close friendship with fellow student Jonathan Wodowski, the two slowly fell madly in love with one another. But come 2007, Annie had finished her undergrad degree and was searching for the perfect school to continue her graduate studies. Jonathan had been accepted to Columbia in New York City to pursue a master's in applied physics and mathematics. But Annie had her sights set on a different program. She wanted to go to Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, where she could get her doctorate in pharmacology. The two knew the next several years wouldn't be easy on the relationship, but they also knew that they wanted to stay together. So they agreed to go their separate ways academically, but vowed to stay together by keeping in touch daily and visiting one another whenever their studies allowed. Which wasn't that difficult. The trip between their two schools wouldn't be more than 2 hours one way. So in September 2007, Annie begrudgingly said her goodbyes to Jonathan and began her journey on the Ivy League campus. So founded back in 1701, Yale is somewhat of a time capsule in the town of New Haven, with around 260 historic buildings, gorgeous wrought iron gates, and tree-lined paths. The campus is a picturesque, if not distracting, place to study. Today, its enrollment count is about 14,000, which seems small, but I mean, it's Yale. But as former Yale president Richard Levin once said, the campus was, quote, large enough to be interesting, yet small enough to be friendly. Which is why Annie Lee felt right at home, nestled comfortably in her new living quarters. And like many Yale students, Annie didn't venture far off campus too much. The neighborhoods surrounding Yale had their fair share of crime, drugs, gangs, the occasional shootings. Although there were many people in the New Haven area who came to the campus to find employment at the university, even today, Yale is New Haven's biggest employer. But, as might be the case with any college town, the locals had their issues with the constantly expanding campus and the wealth and privilege that these students brought to their middle-class town. You know, things like increased traffic, gentrification, drunken college kids, partying into the night, that kind of stuff. There was sort of an unspoken rift between the university and those that lived in New Haven full-time. One that Annie was seemingly aware of because campus safety was always an issue at the forefront of Annie Lee's mind. In fact, she had written an article for the student magazine offering tips on how to avoid becoming a victim of a dangerous crime. In the article, Annie acknowledged that on-campus thefts were on the rise, some of which included violent confrontations, and it was important to be aware of your surroundings. After including interviews with the Yale Police Department's chief of police, Annie concluded her article with one foreboding statement, and it's read, quote, New Haven is a city, and all cities have their perils. But with a little street smarts, one can avoid becoming another statistic. And unfortunately, Annie would soon learn it just wasn't that simple. Over the next year, Annie buckled down and focused on her studies, as well as maintaining her long-distance relationship with her boyfriend, Jonathan. In fact, during one visit in 2008, he got down on one knee and asked Annie if she would spend the rest of her life with him. And she was over the moon, eager to start planning their wedding immediately. The couple set a date and a location. Sunday, September 13th, 2009, in a gazebo overlooking a pond in New York. But Annie didn't let the wedding planning get in the way of her research projects. By her second year, she had already begun working on her dissertation topic, the effects certain proteins have on metabolic diseases such as diabetes or cancer, which meant that Annie spent a lot of her free time in Yale's state-of-the-art medical building at 10 Amistad Street, about a 20-minute walk just outside of campus. Most of her time in that lab was spent monitoring and testing the effects of different medicines on mice and rats. But the way Annie saw it, it was all for a good cause. Her ultimate goal was to find new ways to cure any of these debilitating conditions. So come September 8th, 2009, Annie was less than a week away from walking down the aisle. With all the final details in place, Annie calmed her nerves by distracting herself with her research. That morning, the first chill of fall was already descending upon the campus. The leaves were preparing to change their colors. Annie was packing her books and hopping aboard the campus shuttle for her office at Sterling Hall, just a few blocks down from 10 Amistad. Annie put her books down on her desk and finished a bit of homework. Afterwards, she grabbed her magnetic ID card to go check on the status of her mice, like she'd done several times before. Annie left her purse, wallet, and cell phone in her office and locked the door. She planned to be back in less than an hour or two, and it was around 9 a.m. when video surveillance captured Annie entering the Amistad building, a building with one of the most intense security systems on Yale property. There were more than 70 different cameras focused on the complex. The only way to get in and around the inside of the building was by using one of those magnetic ID cards. This was mainly due to the neighborhood and the fact that the medical research building had been targeted before by animal rights activists looking to free the lab subjects. So after entering the building, Annie's ID card swiped into her Professor Bennett's lab. It's room G13. She put on her white lab coat, checked on the mice in their cages, and began writing up that day's observation report. But around 12:40 p.m., a fire alarm went off in the 10 Amistad building, and hundreds were forced to evacuate, waiting a safe distance outside for the all clear to go back in, and many presumed Annie was among them. But come 5 p.m., Annie's housemates, who had been awaiting her return, were starting to wonder about her. Interesting. It wasn't unheard of for Annie to get caught up in the lab and spend several hours longer on her work than initially promised. However, when 7 p.m. rolled around and her roommates began trying her cell phone to no avail, they started to worry. It got even worse when they realized no one had heard from Annie for most of the day, including her fiancé, Jonathan, who she was set to marry in just a week. Once 10 p.m. came around with no sign of Annie, her roommates decided it was time to alert campus police. The roommates mentioned that not only had no one heard from her all day, she'd also missed her late afternoon class, which was highly unlike her. What was even more alarming was the fact that Annie was just a few days away from getting married. Like I said, she wouldn't just up and disappear like that. When campus police hear this, they think, yeah, maybe. I mean, it's not completely unheard of for someone to get cold feet. I feel like it's so hard because it's probably just the stories that we do, obviously, because we're a true crime podcast. It seems like every time we do a case like this, the police or campus police say the same thing. You know, it's just the pattern. Oh, they probably ran away. They're probably just decompressing, blah, 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 blah. But I know there's plenty of opposite times where people report it and they go and help. It just, again, excuse me, you know what I'm saying? Well, I will say in this case, the theory falls to the wayside pretty quickly when the police check on Annie's office over at the Sterling building, because there they find that her cell phone, purse, and wallet are still there. Knowing that Annie was planning to head over to Amistad, they spent the night and into the following day closely examining footage from the outside of the building. So they're like, this was her kind of whereabouts, so we're going to look. Thank goodness there's cameras. Well, come the next day, news of Annie's disappearance was already catching on. While police were combing the footage on Wednesday, Annie's faculty advisor reported that she hadn't shown up for work at the lab that morning. Plus, she failed to notify the 8 other students in her group of her absence, which was the usual protocol. And when Annie missed more classes that afternoon, the whole campus kind of started to whisper. Had Annie run off with someone else? Was she kidnapped? Or was the truth even worse? Hours later that day, after the police had completed combing through footage of the exterior of Amistad, they discovered a grainy shot of Annie. She was entering the building in the same clothes that she left the house in that morning. She went missing, carrying some sort of boxy-looking object. Problem was, they never found another image of Annie leaving the building. So was it possible the 411 brunette had been lost somewhere in the crowd during that fire drill and never made it back inside? Because if you remember, everyone exited the building at one point, and they couldn't find her exiting. But I mean, that was a lot of people leaving. For now, police found it important to zero in on Amistad, since as of now, it was the last place she was seen. So they searched through a parking lot, sifted through trash cans and dumpsters, but nothing turned up. By 7:30 p.m. that evening, with still no sign from the 24-year-old Annie, campus police officially declared her a missing person. By Friday afternoon, September 11th, Annie should have been getting a manicure, preparing for her weekend wedding. Instead, the entire town of New Haven was on high alert, searching for the missing bride. A local news outlet offered $10,000 reward for any information pertaining to Annie's case. Jonathan had come up from New York to help assist in the search for his soon-to-be wife, and a full-on manhunt had begun in earnest. And it had to have been planned, because what are the chances there's a fire alarm that goes off? There's enough commotion, so she goes, the cameras can't see her, you know? There's that many. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, it had to have been planned. He had to have targeted her, he or she, because there's no way with that many cameras you can get away with this so easily. By Saturday, campus police were joined by Connecticut State Police, combing every inch of 10 Amistad for signs of the missing Annie. Every door, locker, bathroom, and lab were scanned, when one small detail caught an investigator's eye. A ceiling tile that looked askew, almost as if it had been tampered with. When one detective removed the file and reached into the space above, they found a white sock with what appeared to be bloodstains and a single rubber glove. After bagging and tagging the items as evidence, police uncovered even more.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Disturbing signs that they might be honing in on Annie's fate, including a pair of work boots in the locker room that appeared to have bloodstains and were missing a shoelace. They also discovered a pair of scrubs with blood on the shirt pocket. In one room, they found what appeared to be aspirated bloodstains on a wall. And in Annie's lab, another sign of blood spatter that someone had tried to clean up. But here's the thing. This is a lab, right? And there's a lot of animal testing going on. So detectives have to ask themselves, is this blood they're finding even human? Well, that's what DNA testing is for. But unfortunately, that's a bit of a waiting game. So come Sunday, September 13th, Annie should have been slipping into her wedding dress and putting the final touches on her vows. Her family should have been preparing to walk her down the aisle as she and Jonathan danced the afternoon away. Instead, police were back in the halls of Amistad, this time with a canine unit, to search for any new clues about the missing bride's whereabouts. And unfortunately that day, they found the biggest clue of them all. At around 4:30 p.m., officers entered a locker room on the lower level of the facility and were met with a disturbing odor. Now, the seasoned detectives knew this just wasn't some old socks and gym shorts. They were definitely smelling a decomposing body. So one of the dogs followed the scent to a toilet and began barking towards the wall behind it. There was a panel about the size of a computer screen, which detectives removed to find an 8-inch space used to hide the piping. Only on that piping insulation was a bunch of bloodstains. And how does this person know all these crevices and spaces? And as they moved in deeper, they found the source, the dead body of a young woman, still wearing surgical gloves with a stained lab coat and one white sock. Her body had been so contorted, so mangled to fit into this tiny space, that she was hardly recognized. But there was no denying this was the missing Annie Lape. After Annie's body was analyzed by the state medical examiner, they found that her cause of death was traumatic asphyxiation by neck compression. So in other words, Annie had likely been choked to death. They also discovered that her jaw and her collarbone had been broken, which they believed happened before Annie had died. Her bra had been pushed up and her underwear was around her ankles, and it appears as if her attacker had left his DNA behind. Which meant they had a pretty good chance of figuring out who killed Annie, especially thanks to the location where Annie was discovered, because remember, the Amistad building requires a badge to access each room. So not only was it likely the person had a badge and worked inside the building, maybe another student, professor, even a janitor, it was also likely that they had the key card system recorded when they entered each room. But here's the thing. Police didn't seal off Amistad until after they found Annie's body, so people were moving in and out of the building before this. So for 6 full days while she was missing, people were coming and going, literally contaminating a crime scene. Although, to be fair, police claimed that they weren't aware that they were dealing with a homicide at the time.
Excuse me.
It was just a missing persons case. The other complication was, while the security system outside of Amistad was seemingly very tight, there was no surveillance cameras inside the building. You know, no one learns. No one ever learns. I mean, this case was back in 2009. I mean, we're in an age where there's a lot of cameras, but it's also not 2023 where there are cameras everywhere. But it does seem odd that they have so many cameras outside the building and nothing inside. Plus, most of the rooms were soundproof, which meant anyone screaming for help probably wouldn't have been heard. But there was one witness who came forward on September 9th, 4 days after Annie was found, to say he saw something that might be useful to the investigation. So we're kind of jumping back in time a little bit. So let's go back to that Wednesday morning before police found Annie's body. That day, they're still combing every inch of Amistad looking for evidence when one of the lab techs approaches Officer Jennifer Garcia with the Yale Police Department. He says he has some information about Annie the day before. The last day she was seen, he saw Annie leaving the building at around 12:30 p.m., right before the fire alarm went off. She was carrying a notebook and two bags of mouse food, but he didn't speak to her or ask her where she was going. So Detective Garcia takes note of this, and she figures at least now they have a window of time frame where they can recheck those cameras, maybe see if they spot Annie leaving. Now the following day, Garcia returns to Amistad with Officer Sabrina Wood and a team of others. And this time, something even more alarming is brought to their attention. That day, a different coworker of Annie's goes up to Wood to say, "Hey, there's something that I think you need to check out." She leads Wood over to a box of wipes on a steel pushcart and says, "Doesn't that look like blood to you?" And it absolutely does. So Wood pages the other members of her team to come take samples. But as she waits for them to arrive, the lab tech comes over and starts chatting them up. Meanwhile, he's leaning on the steel cart, trying to move that box of wipes out of their line of sight. And then, strangely, he starts mopping the area around the cart. Now, I have no idea why this tech was even allowed in a potential crime scene while they were investigating. The whole thing just reads very strange to me and very unprofessional. Because I'm just screaming while researching, like, stop him, what the hell is going on? But on the other hand, it ends up leading them to their first real suspect once they find her body. Right? Because, surprise, surprise, the tech is the same one who told Garcia the day before that he saw Annie leaving the building for the fire alarm. Big, big red flags. His name was Raymond Clark. Raymond was a 24-year-old, handsome, former athlete, star pitcher and quarterback for his high school teams. The kind of guy people describe as a bit shy, but also extremely personable with a great sense of humor. Despite graduating from high school with honors, Raymond decided he wasn't interested in pursuing a college degree. He wanted to stay in town, be close to his family, and get a job nearby. In fact, he figured maybe he could get some work at one of Yale's medical labs, where his sister and brother-in-law were already employed. After all, the tech jobs paid fairly well, if you could stomach much of that work. So most of Raymond's day was spent scraping dirty animal cages, lifting heavy bags of food and bedding, and euthanizing the animals when asked. Lab techs like Raymond bore a lot of the responsibility of watching over the subjects, making sure everything was ethically up to code. And oftentimes, if something went wrong, they were also the ones that the professors and students blamed. Because of this, there was somewhat of a divide between the scientists and the techs. Much like the divide I explained before between the students and the locals.
Yes, sir.
So when it came to Raymond Clark, most of the students and professors working in Amistad said he just kept his head down. That he liked working at the lab because he not only got to work with his sister and brother-in-law, but also his new fiance. The couple had gotten their own apartment and a dog, with plans to tie the knot in December of 2011. So where's the motive to kill someone? Well, there were others who said that underneath that people-pleasing jokester, there was another side of Raymond Clark. Apparently, he was quite a stickler for the rules, a control freak who would tolerate or who would berate you if you didn't do something like wear shoe covers in the lab. Even Raymond's high school girlfriend had some choice words about her ex. She said he became extremely controlling as the relationship went on, telling her what to wear, who she could socialize with, and on more than one occasion, he got physical with her during an altercation. When she tried to break up with Raymond, she received menacing threats in her locker room and eventually filed a police report for both stalking and sexual assault, but she never followed through on pressing charges. Even Raymond's new neighbors said they have a few uncomfortable and threatening confrontations with the 24-year-old lab tech. So knowing all this, police start to zero in on Raymond Clark, and here's what they unravel. On September 8th, the day Annie disappeared, Raymond's key card swiped into Professor Bennett's lab, room G13, at five different times. Now, if you remember this is the same day, same room where Annie's key card swiped. Usually he only went in there once a day, but on this day, he goes in five times. He also swiped in several times after working hours, which was uncharacteristic of him, including a few times in the locker room where Annie's body was later found. But the last time Annie had used her key card was around 10:11 a.m. that morning. It was to enter G13, and after that, her key card was never used again. Raymond was brought in for questioning shortly after, trying to cover up the blood spatter in that room, right around September 10th. So a few days before more evidence in Annie's body were found. But things just got even worse for him when he sat across from the police. For starters, they realized he had these deep scratches all over his face, which he claimed, and we've heard this before, was actually from his cat. So Raymond Clark was not making things easy on himself. Then Saturday, September 12th rolled around, and police found those bloody work boots and blue hospital scrubs. When police analyzed the tape taken from the morning of the 8th, Raymond was pictured entering the building in scrubs just like them. And when he was seen leaving later, Raymond was in a completely different outfit. So it's all caught on camera, basically, and all the keycard information as well. It's also funny because if he didn't say anything to police the first time, I believe that they would have eventually solved it, but it would have been a lot harder. There might not have been as many details available, so it's kind of interesting that he tried to cover himself, and that's what ended up screwing him. Yeah, but it wasn't until after they found Annie's body on the 13th that police could finally get a warrant for his arrest. So you and the audience didn't really know that they kind of already had the suspect by the time they found her body, particularly after they confirmed the DNA found on Annie's body did in fact belong to Raymond Clark. So on September 17th, they moved in on Raymond, arresting him at a Super 8 motel. Knowing there was no turning back, he walked away peacefully in handcuffs. But even with Raymond behind bars, now officially charged with the murder, there were still so many lingering questions. Like what happened between the two of them that led to Annie's death, and what caused Raymond Clark to commit such a twisted crime. So let's go back once more to September 8th, 2009, the last day Annie was seen alive. That morning, she supposedly received a text message from Raymond asking her to come in early. He wanted to discuss how Annie kept her workspace, or more specifically, the cleanliness of her mice cages. Apparently, the two had discussions about it before, and some thought Raymond might have been at his wit's end with her. It's believed that once Annie entered G13, Raymond came in and confronted her about the issue. This would have been a little after 10 a.m. During that point, things must have escalated. Raymond likely got violent with Annie, maybe shoving her or knocking her unconscious, which would explain some of the blood spatter on the walls of that room. Trying to cover up the crime, whether intentional or accidental, Raymond likely placed Annie in a metal cart, much like the one he was trying to conceal around detectives. He then moved her body to a more discreet location, and in order to do so, he pulled the fire alarm to get everyone out of the building first. As people were filing out of the building, he seemingly moved Annie to the next room, where he might have realized that Annie was still conscious. That's when he began choking her, which can explain the aspirated blood police found on the wall of a different room. After that, Raymond went around the building with Annie covered in the pushcart, looking for the perfect place to hide her body. He eventually came to the locker room, and that's where he found the perfect spot to stuff the 4'11", 90-pound Annie into the wall. So after this, he found the time to file out of the building with the last stragglers in order to secure himself an alibi. So he hides the body and then immediately bolts out, trying to act like he also left. At least this is the theory that prosecutors laid out during Raymond Clark's trial, but there was still one outstanding detail. What motivated Raymond to commit this crime? Was he really just that annoyed by Annie's mess that would cause him to kill her? Well, according to a workplace violence prevention specialist named Hector Alvarez, workplace-related anger does have the potential to be the sole motivator here. He claims that some people will quietly, to quote, allow their emotions to escalate until they reach a breaking point. But a psychiatrist named Dr. Michael Wellner says that the most common cause of workplace violence is usually triggered by romantic rejection, which would make sense considering that Raymond's DNA was found on Annie's body. Perhaps with Annie's wedding getting closer, he felt he'd be losing her forever. And if he couldn't have her, nobody could. But he also had a fiance. Others say that Annie's race could have played a role. Those who knew Raymond back in high school said that, as a white man, they found it unusual he chose to be a part of the Asian Awareness Club, which aimed to celebrate the variety of Asian cultures among students. Which I find that's actually a little interesting. Which is why some wondered if Annie might have checked some sort of sexual preference for Raymond, leading to a deadly obsession. Regardless of what was going on in Raymond's head, he stood before a court in January of 2010 and pleaded not guilty. But in March 2011, he changed that plea to guilty to reduce his sentence. He was also found guilty of attempted sexual assault. Raymond Clark will be serving 44 years in prison, where he will remain until 2053. But what was really going on in Raymond's head before he woke up the morning of September 8th might forever be a mystery. And that is the case of Annie Lee. She had such a bright future ahead of her as well. Like, the week before her wedding, like, that's just a horrible time for all this to go down. Well, that is our case for this Murder Monday. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section below. Give us a thumbs up if you like our video. Hit that subscribe button down below. Hit the bell notification button to be notified of future videos. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.